The velocity at which our country is changing at the moment cannot be overstated. Nearly every time we look up, a new executive order or tweet or the telling of a non-truth has become news. And just this week, our fair city was the subject of one such tweet, grossly misstating what the city of Chicago is all about and certainly misrepresenting its citizens. And while plenty of people are pushing for dialogue and understanding, plenty of others are past all that and are focusing on action instead. One such action, of course, is information. Way in advance, we planned tonight to talk about all the fascinating exhibits hosted by various museums around Chicago. And indeed, we're going to do that. But isn't it tone-deaf to talk about something light and cultural and, dare I say, even fun when so much is weighing on so many of us, rapid changes echoing around the globe? Well, maybe not. Given the state of the world, the country, and the concerns of many citizens right here in Chicago, our centers of culture and history take on new significance, especially such institutions have gathered and preserved artifacts and information and culture of very specific communities. Museums, after all, preserve the past and perhaps help us better understand ourselves, each other, and the many narratives that make up history. After all, there is never a single story, despite what history books may have us believe, with presenting simply the prevailing ones. Thinking of it that way, the importance of museums is only going to increase, because what's past is present, and we need to understand histories now more than ever. And that is what museums do. So, we're still going to talk about museums in Chicago tonight. An institution by definition that cares for a collection of artifacts and objects of cultural, historic, creative, or scientific significance as decided by those who know that community best, whether from a moment in time, from an uprising or a downfall, from a specific group of humans being connected by identity, race, shared experience, religion, or profession. Tonight, that's what we'll aim to explore, the significance of museums and their histories, and some special projects of museums right here in Chicago. Lovely, wonderful, strong, and determined Chicago. Not without its flaws, to be sure, but certainly a fine city, despite what a certain Twitter account might say. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN.
Town in America.
This is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio? Well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN. Indeed, it is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth. Thank you for being with us tonight and for sharing part of your Saturday evening. I know there's a lot of stuff going on this evening, and I appreciate you sharing your time with me. So tonight, we are going to be taking a look at museums. I know exactly what you're thinking. Museums? This show? While the world seems to be in such turmoil? I hear you. I hear that. I do. But also, when misinformation or partial information about groups of people is flying around, isn't the pursuit of history and its lessons important? Well, it's not insignificant, that's for certain. So, tonight we will be talking about the cultural and historic significance of museums, and we'll be talking about some special projects happening at museums right here in Chicago. We'll be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. Young souls, 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. And tonight we have been talking about museums. And while that might seem like an odd topic tonight, given that there are so many very, very urgent topics in the news, in fact, we're talking about the cultural and historic significance of museums and why perhaps they matter more than ever as we look to museums devoted to different communities of people and how we're trying to look at the past to understand the present and the future. So joining us now is Victoria Kane from Northeastern University. She has studied at Harvard and Columbia and published widely on the history of American museums, exhibitions, collecting, film, and photography. Her first book, Life on Display, Revolutionizing Museums of Science and Nature in the United States, is a social and cultural history of exhibitions in the 20th century museums of science and nature. And so welcome to the program, Victoria Kane. Hi, Victoria. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks so much, Amy. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us. I appreciate you sharing part of your Saturday with us. Well, so we've been wrestling with this idea of museums and why they're perhaps more important right now than ever, from in terms of learning about each other and ourselves and our histories and our learning, you know, looking to the past to understand the present and the future. Where do you fall on that in terms of museums right now in the present climate of this country?
I think museums are essential. They are some of our most trusted civic institutions at a time where, you know, people don't really know who to believe or what to believe. Museums remain places that, you know, the American Association or the American Alliance of Museums has done studies, and you know, something like 90% of Americans say that museums remain some of the most the places that they really trust for information. So that's an important, you know, an important kind of gathering place. The other thing that's really important about museums is that they aspire to really create community and to bring all kinds of people through their doors and to represent the experiences of all kinds of people. Now, they haven't always done that. That's a relatively recent phenomenon, but it's one of the reasons that museums are all the more special and important these days.
Right. So tell me about that earlier significance and how perhaps it wasn't as broad a representation initially in this country anyway with museums.
Well, in Chicago, you know, early on, many, many museums were founded in the 19th century, and they were mostly founded by wealthy industrialists who had sort of a couple reasons for founding them. Some people wanted to put Chicago on the map. They wanted to live in a city that could compete with New York or Paris. And so they wanted to build cultural institutions that could catch up to Chicago's booming population and economy, because Chicago was still seen as pretty backwards in the 19th century. They also, though, wanted to build museums that would instruct the city's immigrant population and really kind of control them. One of the ideas was to build museums that would discipline what they thought of as the unruly masses, and in doing so would prevent riots and strikes and people from questioning, oh, well, you know, I want a raise or I want a weekend. And so they often tried to use museums as a sort of form of social control. Now, that's not to say everybody did that. There were people who were really democratic, and they saw, you know, little d democratic, and they saw museums as a kind of liberating tool. And you see that in museums all over the city as well. I mean, some of them are sort of obvious, like Jane Addams, for instance, who right. founds Hull House. She starts an art gallery there. And the Chicago Herald, actually, the headline announcing this art gallery calls it Art for Poor People, where pictures and books may be enjoyed by those who are not accorded the privileges of more pretentious institutions.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Well, and not all museums were open to everybody. That's the other thing to know about 19th century museums. A lot of times you either had to be literally a member of a club, the club being the museum, or you had to have a certain kind of attitude. And the hours were very limited, so they wouldn't always let you in the door. But then by the end of the century, museums were starting to open their arms more and more. So the Art Institute of Chicago is a really good example. Mm-hmm. Charles Hutchinson, who was a banker, and he, you know, made a pile of cash investing in grain and pork. And he was a big believer that all of Chicago's citizens needed the arts, that they really, that everybody could benefit from this, not just in a let's repress the masses kind of way. Mm-hmm. And so he did things like The exhibition catalogs that went along with the museum exhibits, you know, those sort of $90 coffee table books that go along with museum exhibits nowadays. Well, he insisted when he was in charge of the museum that those exhibition catalogs be free, or even, you know, sometimes they charged a little bit, but it was certainly within the reach of all visitors. So people had very mixed motives, but one of the things a lot of Chicago museum founders wanted to do was to sort of persuade immigrants in particular and insist that they behave in a particular way and that they not, you know, question the establishment. So that, you know, that was that, and that all changed. That changed beginning in the 1950s and 60s, but especially in the 60s, as the world started to change. It was a period of radical change for the United States and very much so for museums.
Very, very interesting. And you know, my earlier guest on the program mentioned Hull House also and was talking about how now there were workshops and things like that, as many museums do. But in particular, this one was about making protest signs and what an interesting way to connect past and present. And I think that's so interesting as you think about who the museums serve, because there's some degree of service for archivists and researchers and scientists. And then there's another degree of it for the public and for educating the public, which I think is really fascinating. And it seems like that role has changed many times over the years in the United States, too.
Very much so. And Chicago was really the epicenter of it. And people began to insist that their needs and tastes and desires be represented both in collections and in the actual galleries. So, for instance, in 1961, Margaret and Charles Burroughs, living on the south side of Chicago, they opened the DuSable in their home because they couldn't believe that the experience of Chicago's African-American community had been so completely ignored by Chicago's museums. So they created their own collection and exhibits that would teach about African-American history and culture. And in doing so, their museum became a center for Black social activism. But the same thing happened at, you know, the then Chicago Historical Society, now the Chicago History Museum. Native American protesters would push against the collection and the exhibits that were up, arguing that what the narrative that the museum was presenting was really damaging, that it was stereotypical and that it was inaccurate. And so they actually centered their protest around the large monument, the 1812 battle at Fort Dearborn, which then was the centerpiece of the lobby. And it took about a decade after their protest, but the museum eventually, you know, changed its whole approach to Native Americans and became much more conscious of both collecting and representing that community and other communities in Chicago, instead of focusing on the founding fathers, which it really had done, you know, up until the 50s and kind of early 60s. They started giving a voice to Chicago's many, many, many immigrant communities, both old and new.
Yeah, very, very interesting, and how kind of the role attached to and the narratives behind the museums themselves, not just the items within them. I think that is so fascinating. And so as we are looking at all these museums and periods of rapid change, where do you see museums beginning to shift again as we're right now again in a period of great change? And kind of what's on the horizon for museums?
Well, you know, that horizon has changed a lot in the last couple weeks, hasn't it?
Yes.
I think one thing that museums are really concerned about, you know, a lot of museums rely on federal funding both to develop exhibits, but also to keep the lights on. The Institute for Museum and Library Sciences, the NEH, the NEA, these are all, even the NSF, the National Science Foundation, they all give lots of money to museums in order to promote education and programming and exhibition and to preserve their collections and to digitize them, making them available for people who might not be able to get to the museum on a free day, or, you know, might not be able to travel. And if that funding is cut, museums are going to be in a very different situation than they are now. So that's one challenge for them. Another major challenge is, again, this kind of question of inclusion and diversity. And that can be in terms of catering to younger audiences. Museums are, you know, really have made great strides in social media in terms of trying to include different kinds of generations. They are also working hard to try to get more different kinds of people through their doors in terms of class and race and ethnicity. And I think thinking about how to host those civic conversations and make them productive is something that museums are really working on. There have been efforts to do community curation and to kind of break down categorical boundaries. So like art museums, you know, they're no longer just focusing on paintings. They're doing a lot of performance art. They're doing music. They're doing film. They're doing all kinds of categories to capture bigger and broader audiences. And then once they're inside a museum, then they can start asking interesting questions and requiring people to think about issues that might otherwise provoke controversy. But museums can be safe spaces in that way, allowing people to think through and talk about issues that might be really frightening outside of the walls of the museum.
Certainly. What do you think the responsibility what responsibility do museums have to the public right now? I think particularly science museums, as we're having a lot of very heated conversations around climate change and that kind of thing, and facts and non-facts and alternative facts and things like that, that are so contentious. Isn't there kind of a greater responsibility on a science museum, their collection, and probably their archives now more than ever?
Absolutely. It's interesting because for a long time, people argued, oh, museums, they don't need all of those specimens anymore. You know, we know what a cardinal looks like. Why do you need 500 or 5,000 or 500,000 examples of cardinals? But it's turned out that those specimens are essential in terms of chronicling the history of biodiversity. And there have been all kinds of new research applications for those natural history collections that in times of great budget cuts, people have said, oh, we don't, just get rid of it. It's not useful to educate the public. And yet in the long game, it is. It's essential to creating new knowledge. So natural history museums in particular are becoming really important sources of information about the impact of things like climate change, of these long-term shifts that are affecting the climate of all kinds of ecosystems and really have the potential to cause enormous devastation. So scientists are really on the front lines of that. But the other issue there with science museums, and I say that broadly, including museums of science and industry and places like the Field and the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum. I mean, these museums are teaching people what a fact means in modern science. The kind of evidence that is necessary for an idea to become a fact or to be revised, and teaching people that there is a scientific process, and, you know, whether it's via peer review or whether it's a series of sort of intellectual check marks, but that you cannot simply make something up and then call it an alternative fact. that in fact, science museums do have a responsibility to serve as kind of ethical and factual guides through the present and the future, of our understandings of the natural world.
Right, right. I want to ask you, too, about technology and how that plays into museums. We do have to take a quick break. We're talking with Victoria Kane from Northeastern University and author of the book Life on Display, Revolutionizing Museums of Science and Nature in the United States, all about the cultural and historic significance of museums and the responsibility of museums to all of us right now. We'll be back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.
All right.
720 WGN. It's the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth, and tonight we're talking all about museums. And I know what you're thinking, like, museums, really, tonight, this show with so much going on in the world? Indeed, because there is so much that we can look to museums for right now to learn, to look at the past, to learn about the present and the future. There's so much there, and it's very important that we preserve them. We've been talking with Victoria Kane and having a wonderful conversation. She is an assistant professor in the history department at Northeastern University and author of the book Life on Display, Revolutionizing Museums of Science and Nature in the United States. Thanks for staying with us, Victoria. I really appreciate you being with us tonight. So
it's a pleasure.
Right before the break, we were talking about many things about museums and why they're so very important. We think of them as kind of something to do on our day off, but really they have a great historic significance, particularly science museums and their role in the war on facts, as we have been saying, and the non-facts and all of those things, because truth is up for a debate right now in such a bold way. Every time we look at our social media feeds or many broadcast outlets, we're hearing about this.
Mm-hmm.
Even the first Twitter account is, in fact, debating facts. So it's very important as we're looking to those kinds of things. But as we look even further ahead, what is that role that technology can play in museums? You know, it used to be the most kind of cutting edge thing was maybe cool lights and a cool way of displaying things, or those like big clunky earphones on the guided tours. But now it seems like they're so interactive and for a while, we were seeing QR codes in museums, and then it's moved beyond that to, in fact, digital and virtual wings. What in museums, maybe even outside of Chicago, have really caught your eye in terms of innovation in that technical space?
Well, it's interesting. In the early 2000s, I think a lot of museums were worried about the digital revolution. I mean, they were genuinely convinced that, oh, well, people can see, you know, La Grande Jatte on their computer, so they won't go to the Art Institute. Mm. But it turned out that, in fact, digitizing all of these objects and making them more public just whetted people's appetites, and that people would see things on their screens and then they would want to come in and see the real thing. So in some ways, this kind of digital shift has been terrific for museums. It's allowed them to kind of get to people who might not otherwise become museum fans. I think social media has been really important in terms of reaching a lot of different populations and allowing museums to take some risks that they might not otherwise. So, for instance, there's a contemporary artist named Frances Stark. She's taken over the social media feeds at a couple art museums, including museums in Chicago. And that's been tremendous fun to kind of experiment with. There's another trend in the museum world called Museum 2.0, which was started by a Californian named Nina Simon. And her idea is, hey, you know, in this kind of decentralized expertise of the web, why don't museums adopt that same mentality? And we can look to our audiences and outside our own walls as experts instead of providing this top-down model where our curators are in charge and we tell you what you should be looking at. Why don't we tell you some things we like and we think you should be looking at, and then you tell us some things you like and you should be looking at. So you see a lot more community curated shows, if you will, and efforts and programming. So in some ways, you know, I think this turn towards the digital has really helped museums become much more responsive to their audiences. One problem, I would say, is that sometimes museums can be a little overwhelming in their effort to this sort of headlong rush to introduce the digital into their halls. And sometimes there are, you know, the touch screen can distract and replace quiet sustained concentration on the real thing. Not that that's the only way to be in a museum. Certainly if you have children, you know that it is not.
Right.
But you know, a lot of people still like to go to museums to actually look at objects. And sometimes all the glowing screens, either the ones held or brought in by visitors, and then the ones provided by museums,
right,
can distract from that.
Yeah.
But in general, I think the digital revolution has been really great for museums.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting, too, how that can kind of address different types of learning styles. I think immediately of Newseum, the big journalism,
right,
and news museum in Washington, D.C., that's so fascinating. There's so much to do in there. It's not just,
yeah,
looking at things. It's watching films, interacting with things, pressing buttons, asking questions, doing things. There's a lot of cool stuff that you leave having,
right,
had a richer experience. So that's
right,
cool to hear.
And I think that's a big and important point about science museums in particular. Science museums create space for kids who might not like science in a classroom setting and might not embrace it otherwise to learn science in informal ways, and to have a lot of fun doing it. And that's one area that science museums are really trying to carve out for themselves. I think in, you know, this effort to meet the Common Core and sort of, oh, we need to connect our exhibits to curriculum to bring in more audiences, a lot of science museums have actually staked out the opposite terrain, and they've said, you know what, we're not schools. We do something totally different, and we're going to really embrace that, and we're going to invite in the people who learn in a whole variety of ways, and we're going to create exhibits for them. And that's, you know, they have become increasingly, really sort of since the late 60s, places where people, and specifically children, can really get their hands dirty in a way that they might not be able to in the classroom. And so I don't see that changing. If anything, I think that that is going to continue, you know, and is especially important in communities where, you know, schools might be underfunded.
Truly.
Kids might not have the opportunity to touch objects or get into the lab or do the kind of interaction with scientists kind of on the job that you can get at the field or at the Museum of Science and Industry.
So very interesting. I wish we had hours more to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us tonight and sharing all of your information. Victoria Kane, Assistant Professor in the History Department at Northeastern University and author of the book Life on Display, Revolutionizing Museums of Science and Nature in the United States. Thanks so much.
Live from the biggest small town in America,
this is WGN Chicago, radio home of millions throughout Mid-America.
Radio, well, radio became the Pied Piper to a strange new world.
Time to climb up on our big shoulders and get inside our massive heart.
This is the Saturday Night Special with Amy Guth.
720 WGN. Indeed, it is the Saturday Night Special, and I'm Amy Guth, and I am very grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with us. We have been talking about museums tonight because I know you're thinking, but you do so many political things on this show. Why are you talking about museums? Here is why. Because I believe we can learn a lot by looking to the past. We can learn a lot about the future and the present. And also, perhaps recently there was a tweet sent by a prominent person that perhaps suggested that Chicago was not the fantastically phenomenal city that it is. But it is. It is a phenomenal city. And so we've been talking about museums and the cultural significance of them and the historic significance of them. But this hour, we're going to shift a little bit and talk to some people doing really cool work right inside of museums here in Chicago. I'm very, very excited about this part indeed. Please welcome to the program Dr. Andy Cao and Kelsey Ryan from The Shed. Hi, guys. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Lean into that mic so we can hear you. There you go. That's the one. All right. That mic in particular is a little bit shy. So thank you so much, both of you, for being here tonight, because I think when we think of The Shed, there's so much going on. Sometimes it is a little overwhelming, but there are some really, really important projects going on right now. But it seems like every time I look up, there's a new thing. There's like a sustainable dinner, and there's mm-hmm. this, and there's a kids program, and there's this. There, how many programs are you going, are you running at any given time at the shed?
Oh, there are so many. We have a whole learning department. So they work with our Chicago Public Schools, and they have learning programs that kids can come in maybe after school and go into our teen learning lab. So they're educational programs. There are conservation programs where we're out actually on the shorelines of Lake Michigan picking up trash that might have been left behind, or we're out in forest preserves removing invasive species. And then there's also, of course, kind of a big reason why we're here today, we have research. And so I know a lot of people heard a lot about our Great Lakes research because it is so close to us and it's in our backyard, but we also have a lot going on outside of Chicago, and so a lot of conservation research. That's another program. So
sure. Mm-hmm. I'm really super interested in kind of the dual role of a museum, both how it serves researchers or mm-hmm. researchers and scientists, but then also how it serves the public and kind of the responsibility to the public. I think that part is super interesting. So Dr. Andy Cao, you are doing some very, very cool things. And I learned something as you walked into the studio. And I think a lot of Chicagoans perhaps do not know that the shed is not just in Chicago. And in fact, you're doing work in other parts of the world. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so actually Chicago has, or the shed has, a few different research outposts. And one of those that's been going on for decades now, actually, is down in the Bahamas. And the heart and soul of that program is this big old research vessel. It's 80 feet long, based out of Miami. That's constantly going back and forth from Miami to the Bahamas. And in the Bahamas, there are several programs that we're working on. So my boss, Dr. Chuck Knapp, has been studying Bahamian rock iguanas for decades. But also, more recently, the people of the Bahamas have been interested in trying to protect some of their marine resources, specifically Nassau grouper, which is endangered, and the threatened queen conch, which is what I study.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And that's got to be a pretty good place for a Chicago researcher to be in warmer weather in the Bahamas, going between Miami and the Bahamas.
Yeah, you would think so. But actually, I was just down there a few weeks ago. And while it's certainly sunny and plenty of sand and beautiful weather, it's also the stormy season. Mm-hmm. So we had sustained 40 knot winds, which is tropical storm is like 45. So it was pretty unpleasant and gave us a really limited window for when
sure.
we could do our research.
Sure. And does that set your research back when you have conditions like that? Or is it only really setting your research back when you are in that storm and hurricane area?
No, we account for it. So we just had a limited window, but we still managed to accomplish all of our goals. And
okay.
specifically, we were looking at Nassau grouper spawning this time of year.
So why these species in particular?
Well, starting with Nassau grouper,
yeah.
They are endangered, critically endangered. And why are they endangered? Well, it has to do with their life history. So these animals are predators, and they're typically dispersed around the Bahamas. But they come together for breeding and mating, and they do so in a really grand fashion, where you get thousands and thousands of fish that come together consistently during the winter full moons at the same locations for spawning.
Wow. And full moons even.
Yep, the full moons. I guess the mood is right.
Sure.
But because this is so predictable in space and time, that means that fishermen can also monopolize this.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these spawning aggregations where there were once thousands of fish are disappearing.
And so you have this very small window to study them then, if it's all connected to moons and a particular time. So that involves, I assume anyway, studying them in the dark.
You would think so, but actually there's a bunch of different techniques that we can use. So in order to look at the fine scale movements and what the fish are actually doing during the spawning aggregation, yes, we have to come and scuba dive on these aggregations to check out what the fish are doing throughout the day. We don't actually do that at night because that's a little dangerous, and we try to keep very safe. But there's other techniques that we can use as well. So one of the researchers from the Bahamas who's completing her PhD in England is using population genetics to look at how the different grouper around the Bahamas are related to each other. And then Shed has taken the lead with putting up a big acoustic telemetry study. So this is basically we go down and collect some grouper, and the life support system on the research vessel, the Coral Reef 2, allows us to implant these fish with little tags that transmit a unique sound. And then they have acoustic receivers along the coasts So as the animals move, they'll beep, and we're able to detect and say when and where they're moving and migrating.
How interesting. And what has, since you have started doing that, what have you learned from them that's maybe been surprising?
Well, one of the really surprising things is that they can actually, and this was recently published, I believe, is that they do multiple runs every single year. So they'll go and they'll spawn, and then they'll come back and spawn again. And they're also traveling together. But also, unfortunately, we documented the disappearance of a very large spawning aggregation along the way.
And that was that about pollution, or was that about fishing, or both?
Almost certainly fishing.
So talk to me a little bit about pollution. I know we think about that, and we think of the shed as like promoting so many like healthy choices and sustainability, and there's so many sustainable programs there. How are you combating that in your research, or does it factor in much, or talk to me about that a bit.
Yeah, I did. When I was sitting here, actually, I noticed that there was a big thing about road salt coming in the Tribune. But in marine ecosystems, especially around coral reefs, there's a thing called a phase shift where too much agricultural runoff will come out and can potentially create large blooms of algae, which negatively impacts the ecosystem.
How interesting. And so you mentioned there are other research facilities connected to the shed that are elsewhere. Where are the other ones?
So it's primarily here in Chicago, and then the outpost I was talking about is the Coral Reef 2, which is the research vessel down in the Bahamas.
Oh, got it. Okay. I thought maybe it sounded like there was a couple more somewhere in there floating around. That's very, very interesting. And so what is, I would connect this one or throw this question to you, Kelsey, but what are the main goals of the sustainability programs at the shed when you're thinking about kind of the overarching themes of all these programs? What are you most hoping to accomplish with them?
Sure. Basically, our whole goal is to protect our environment and to make sure that generations down the line can still enjoy the beauty of it and all that it provides us. So whether that's making sure that our coastlines are upheld and that they're protected, or maybe that's making sure that people can continue to eat the same seafood dinners that they love. So it's ultimately taking our expertise and having the animals as the ambassadors for those that are out in the wild, and using what they can provide us to kind of have people rally around that and have a good feeling about the environment and inspire them to want to protect it ultimately.
I love that, animals as ambassadors to the others. I enjoy that very much. There's always good quotes that come from guests here. But quickly, I have another question. Let me back up a little bit, because I do recall there was something about a shark sanctuary somewhere in this research that you encountered or something like that. Tell me about that, if you would.
Well, the Bahamas is actually one of the largest shark sanctuaries in the world. So they put a complete blanket ban on longline fishing, which allowed shark populations to rebound. This is great for the dive industry and everything, because tourists love to go down and see and check out the really cool and abundant sharks down the Bahamas.
I really would like to do that, and I think my colleagues think I'm crazy, but I really want to be in the water with a shark. I've encountered a baby one in the Gulf of Mexico-ish, somewhere in there. There was like a baby shark, I think.
Cool. Well, actually, as part of my research with the queen conch, we do a lot of visual surveys.
Okay.
So you get dragged on snorkel behind a small boat. Basically, think about like human shark bait.
I don't think I want to do that. Okay.
It's perfectly safe. We see them, but they never bother you, of course.
Is it one person at a time, or are you talking about many people being...
Yeah, just one person at a time. You get dragged along the seafloor, and you're looking for queen conch and also documenting the habitat.
And so tell me more about that creature, because I think there's probably, just doing a little bit of reading about your work, it seems like there's not a lot of awareness about this creature and why it's so important to protect it right now.
All right. So queen conch are large marine snails. They eat algae, and like snails, they're slow moving. And unfortunately for them, they're also really tasty. So the iconic thing with the queen conch, right, is you can hear the sound of the ocean in their shell. So that's what they are. But they're more like the hot dogs of the Bahamas, I suppose. So like a Chicago-style hot dog. They're really ubiquitous in the culture.
Like the fritters. I've seen those. Yeah,
exactly. So it's really tightly ingrained in the culture of the people there. And since they're slow moving, they live in shallow water, and they taste good, that means that they're also facing some threats from people, particularly with over harvesting. However, the reason that Shedd is involved is the people of the Bahamas have realized that and have started a conservation campaign, get the pun, to come together and build awareness about the plight and also provide research experts such as us, and then ultimately to lobby for legislation to better protect queen conch in the Bahamas.
And what kind of timeline is that when you're lobbying for legislation around a population, a creature population? Is that a long and lengthy process like anything in a government process, or does that go quicker because of the urgency of an endangered species?
Well, sometimes it moves quickly, but a lot of the time, of course, when you're working with an ecological process and conservation, it's small and slow. However, there was a major victory this year, actually, with NASA Grouper, where they closed the harvest season around spawning time when these animals are most vulnerable.
So if someone's listening and they're really feeling like I need to make better choices with my seafood and I need to do these things and I want to get involved in some of these projects, how can people find out more about the work that you're doing or perhaps support it or maybe even support it with their choices that they're making even at restaurants? Where would you send them to start?
Well, first off, I would never say for anyone who's down in the Bahamas on vacation to not eat grouper or not eat conch, but be smart about how you do it. If it's during the closed season for grouper, it's illegal to eat probably.
And when is that season?
And that is during the winter months.
Okay.
So from November until February. And for conch, the government is actually starting a conscious movement.
Lots of puns with that one.
So many. You should hear what we call our boats in the field. This is a group of restaurants that have come together and pledged to only serve and supply adult, mature conch that have had the opportunity to breed and thus replenish the supply for the future so that conch can stay on the menu.
Mm-hmm. And because of their role with, moving slowly along the bottom of the ocean, I have to assume keeping them in abundant supply is also very essential to the ecosystem.
It is. So they are very important grazers in the ecosystem. And also their babies occur in these very, very dense nursery habitats where they are feasted upon by predators to the point that there's almost 99% mortality in the baby conch. So that's a direct energy transfer from the base of the ecosystem upwards. So that's an important role that they have.
Sure. 99%? Is that what you said?
Yeah, in the babies.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. That's not okay. Well, okay, we got it. That's a cause we got to get behind now, everybody. We got to think about the conch shells and the conch fritters and all those things and make better and more conscious choices. And so what are some other sustainability programs happening at the Shedd? If someone's listening and wants to get involved with them, how can they go about doing so?
Sure. So there are a couple different ways that you could kind of join us. So one of the big ways that we say is to protect our Great Lakes is to conserve water. So we're so lucky that we have these huge Great Lakes in our backyard, but we also have to remember to protect them and to conserve that water. So maybe it's not brushing your teeth with the water running or something
sure.
like that. Maybe it's instead of packing your sandwich in a plastic bag, maybe you'll bring a Tupperware with you, a reusable bag. I know that tax is coming up February 1st,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah, now's a good time to make that switch.
Yes. So using a reusable bag when you go to the grocery store or when you go shopping. So there are a variety of different things. If you would go to our website, you could learn all about them. You could pledge to reduce your use of single-use plastics with us.
And you can do that on the Shedd website?
Yes.
Great.
We're asking people to be Sheddvicates.
You guys are all yeah. about the puns.
We love them.
Okay. I love it.
It's always easy to do it when you have animals and you're sure. really in love with the environment. So there are a variety of different ways. If you check out our website, there you can find some of them.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for being with us tonight. We have learned so much from you, and I hope you'll come back and visit us again. Dr. Andy Cow and Kelsey Ryan, thank you so much. And we are big fans of the Shedd, so always happy to chat about the creatures. Last question, can I swim with an otter, please? I really want to do that. Is that a horrible thing to ask?
No,
I hurt them by swimming them?
We get this question a lot. The otters are cute. We'll work on it. We'll
Sweet.
See what we can do.
The funniest thing, the last time I was at the Shedd, there was a kid kind of in front of me looking at the otters, and he goes, "Is that a water kitten?"
Which yes.
That's the best name for otters, the water kittens. All right, you heard it here. I'm going to swim with a water kitten. Good times. All right, thank you both again for being with us tonight. We're going to take a break, get you to news, and check in on the protests happening at O'Hare back in just a bit on 720 W. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. Thank you so much for being with us tonight and sharing part of your Saturday evening with us. We're always very grateful to you for that. And we'll continue these conversations that we've surfaced tonight on the program all week long on social media. You can find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and all the places where the digital things happen. Speaking of digital things, we have been talking about museums tonight. In the first hour, we talked about their significance in the world, both historically and culturally right now, and a bit about what they will mean in the future. And indeed, technology has been a big part of that conversation. So joining us now is Eve Gauss. She is the digital learning manager at the Field Museum, which sounds like a very cool job, certainly a cool title. Welcome to the program, Eve.
Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about, well, first of all, tell us, what does a digital learning manager do? What is that job?
Yes. So a digital learning manager, basically what I do at the Field Museum is we use technology as a bridge to engage teens in the collections and research of the museum. So a lot of people might not know, but the Field Museum is an active research institution. So we have scientists who are going out. We are on all the continents doing active research. So we're excavating dinosaur bones. We're discovering new plant species. We're helping preserve areas in the Amazon for future generations. And so what I do is I basically help with my team is we create programs that use technology as a way to explore that information. So an example would be the museum runs a really robust peregrine falcon program here in Chicago. And so last summer, we brought teens in. They learned about peregrine falcons. They learned about how the museum was really critical to bringing the peregrines back into the state of Illinois because they were extant in the state of Illinois. And then they made videos about that. So they made short 90-second videos that was basically anything that they were interested about peregrines. So some teens took an artistic view of how do we present peregrines in art, and other teens were really interested in the conservation of it, and so they made a video about that. So that's what a digital learning manager does. We basically say, we work with teens, so we work side by side with them to say, what are you interested in about science? And then how can you create meaning from that science using digital tools? So video, 3D printers, game design, stuff like that.
Fascinating.
That's really fun.
You have a very fun job.
It's a very fun job.
That's a very fun job. You know, I think it's very interesting because as we've talked about technology and the role it plays in museums tonight, a couple of themes have come up. And one of them you just touched on a bit, and it is this idea of this shifting nature of it, where it used to be, behold, we are the museum. Mm-hmm. These are the things we must tell you.
Right.
And now it's more of a conversation, it seems. It's
absolutely a conversation. I think particularly with young people, right, is that there's no better way to engage someone in learning than first saying, like, what are you interested in learning about, right? And, you know, the museum tells stories, all kinds of stories of the world, of people in the world, of nature. But those stories don't come alive until we have people who are actively involved in telling the stories from their own communities and how they see those stories and how they reinterpret the stories in their own lens. And I think that's been a huge shift that museums have been going through. And I think that's a phenomenal shift.
Yeah.
It's really a shared ownership of the collections, because we don't hold those collections, right? We hold them in trust for the communities that they come from. And so we work with the communities to then tell the stories.
That's so fascinating. So tell me about the Youth Council, which I think really speaks to this very much.
So the Youth Council is a fantastic program that we have at the museum. And this goes to our idea of, like, how do we work in partnership with communities and people within community in the city of Chicago and throughout the world to tell stories. And so the Youth Council is a way to engage teens at the Field Museum in really having ownership of the museum and really saying, you know, if I'm a young person in Chicago, what do I want the museum to be doing? How do I want them to be telling stories? And how do I make this museum more appealing to people of my own age? And that's what Youth Council is. So it's a group of, this year we have 16 teens. It's a one-year-long commitment. Teens apply for it and they interview for it. And then what they do is they plan other programs for teens. And the really great thing is that Youth Council is actually grew out of the program that Youth Council runs, which is called Curiosity, spelled Curiosity, but we call it Curiosity. was actually an outgrowth of a program that an earlier youth council had run a couple of years ago. And they said, you know, we don't know about careers. Like, we know that there are careers, but what we don't know is, like, how do I get into that career? So if I want to be an environmental biologist, or if I want to be a cultural anthropologist, how do I actually do that? And so they did this one really big program at the end of the year. And what we've done now is we said, hey, that was great, and that was a real need that the young people were expressing. So what if we try to do that on a more regular basis? And so that's what our youth council does, is they plan these events, Curiosity, which is a conversation that's moderated by teens between a field museum scientist and then a cultural professional about how did you get into the career that you're in right now.
Oh, that's super interesting. And I got to assume that's super helpful. That would, I wish I had that when I was a teenager, because it's hard to connect those dots sometimes. And you're like, well, I see that person doing that.
Yeah.
Or worse, what I think is cool about this council and how you're looking at for teens around the city is, what's worse is when you say that person does what I want to do, but that person doesn't look like me. Like, I remember having a lot of conversations about how come only men are on the radio? How come women aren't on the radio? And that was very clear to me. Like, no one's like me, right? You know?
Right. I mean, I think that's, you get to a huge point, is that if you, seeing someone who looks like you, who speaks like you, is so important to young people, right? And you know, that's something that we're really conscious of at the Field Museum, right? So for Curiosity, we really strive to have women speakers for the program. So we've had a couple of fantastic Field Museum women scientists, Crystal Mayer and Janet Voigt, have spoken about their pathway into science. We also are really looking for people of color. So we're really excited on March 4th, Hebrew Brantley is actually going to be our featured cultural speaker in the program. And so, yeah, I think seeing people who look like you, who come from neighborhoods that you come from, and who can tell you about their journey. And I think the thing that, you know, a theme that keeps emerging is that there isn't a straight pathway. No one says when they're 15 years old, I am going to be this, and then has this really clear linear path to getting there. Everyone meanders, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone has, like, oh, they kind of stop off over here, or they thought they were going to want to be something. So Erica Zonnelly is a DNA scientist, and she started out in exhibits and then got so inspired by one of the exhibits that we did on Gregor Mendel that she actually went back to school to get her degree to then do DNA research.
Wow.
Which is just amazing. And so I think what I love about the stories that professionals share with our young people is that you can always change, that nothing is set in stone, and that there are guides and there are helpers along the way that you didn't expect to find, but are so, so important.
I love that. That's so wonderful. I mean, I can remember going on field trips and having what I later realized were profound moments at museums. At the time, I really didn't. But, you know, I think there's power in seeing. I mean, I remember an Egyptian exhibit in particular. There was a lot of, like, women's bodies that looked a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, that was a powerful moment to me. That was that was modesty in two different directions, really. And I thought that was, on a young, impressionable Amy Guth, I thought that was significant. And I'm sure for lots of other young women that were there that day, too. And I think that kind of stuff is so very crucial. And kudos to the Field Museum for really paying so much attention to diversity and representation and all of those things that I think sometimes just get swept aside or you know, are not part of the conversation from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think that is so very important. So let's talk a bit about that, because I think not only seeing someone that looks like you, you know, there's so many conversations about girls in STEM and, mm-hmm. and all of that going on and women in technology, you know, all of those things. But it really speaks to kind of this deeper thing of the role of the museum, both to the public and to the scientists. Because as you mentioned, I believe you said, on every continent?
On every continent, yeah.
And I don't think that's widely known here in Chicago.
Yeah, no, I mean, our scientists are world-class scientists, and they're doing amazing scientific research to really see where is our world and how is it changing. And we really try to get those stories out and tell those stories, because that's like we were talking about before, it is stories that compel people. So, yeah.
Truly.